The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello and welcome to the first post-Vuelta cycling podcast. My name is Richard Moore and this week's show is a little bit different. Due to circumstances that have detained Lionel Burney, we've had to postpone our press conference episode, but we will do it as soon as we can all get together. In this episode, we're going to hear from Francois Thomazeau, who's returned from Canada with a lively report from the two World Tour races in Quebec and Montreal, as well as interviews with Michael Matthews, Nathan Haas, Simon Gerrans and others. In part two, we'll hear from David Miller about his campaign to become president of the CPA, the Riders Union, with the vote on this due to be held at the World Championships in Innsbruck next week. We'll also hear from CPA spokeswoman Laura Mora. And in part three, we'll hear excerpts from two special episodes for friends of the podcast, which are being released this week. One is a Tour of Britain diary from Mark Downey. The other was supposed to be a Tour of Britain diary from Conor Dunn, until his team Aqua Blue Sport pulled the plug on the eve of the race. Instead, Conor and Larry Warbass did their now famous no-go tour, recording for the cycling podcast throughout. This is coming out as a bumper friends special later this week. We'll also hear from Ned Bolting about his forthcoming tour of live shows, and we'll be announcing our Vuelta competition winners. Lots to fit in, so without further ado, let's cross to Francois in Canada.
Well, chaps, as you can hear, I'm in Montreal Airport at the end of a long week of cycling in Canada with two exciting races as usual. It's been 9 years now that we have the Grand Prix Cycliste de Québec and the Grand Prix Cycliste de Montreal. And this year, as you might have watched or seen or discovered or heard, we had a great winner, double winner, Michael Matthews, who was crowned in both Quebec City and Montreal, emulating Simon Gerrans. It was quite an emotional moment for Matthews because, as you know, he had a very lousy season for reasons he will explain later. And, you know, in the same time, he emulated Simon Gerrans' feat of winning both Canadian races in the same year, on the very year when Simon Gerrans announced his retirement at the end of the season. And actually, Simon Gerrans, whom we're going to hear again in this episode, he was there in Canada. He did that in 2014, and it was like passing of the baton between the two, between Gerrans and Michael Matthews. So, yeah, excited racing in Canada here. And I think it's fair to say that the Grand Prix de Quebec and the Grand Prix de Montreal are now, you know, belong, you know, in the grand scheme of classic one-day races. Well, chaps, lots to hear, lots to talk about, and, well, welcome to Canada. I'm now at the start of the Quebec Grand Prix. It's a little bit different from the Montreal one. You have two races because it's more compact. I mean, the circuit is, the climbs are a little bit shorter. It's more a race in which sometimes sprinters have a chance. And what we call baroudeur, I mean, guys like Greg Van Avermaet, Peter Sagan won here. And the favorites today are, well, Greg Van Avermaet again, Michael Matthews, or someone like Oliver Nason. That's the guys we expect to be doing well today. And I'll be talking at the start to a number of riders. I wanted to talk to Nathan Haas because he's done this race before and done well, and he's always a good voice, you know, to talk about, well, races. And of course, I'll talk as well to Simon Gerrans. But the time when I'm speaking is the record holder of wins in Canada. He won three times, either in Quebec or Montreal, and in 2014 he won both Grand Prix races, which is an unprecedented feat. So, well, let's listen to them. Martin, what's so special about these Canadian races? I mean, you seem to enjoy them. All the riders seem to enjoy them. What's different there?
I think we get to stay in a castle, which is pretty cool. It's always nice to come to North America for racing. The crowds are really active and a really positive, engaged audience, which is cool. We like that. We don't like racing in places where no one turns up. But, you know, for me, it's probably a small bias in the fact that I'm good at these races. So, you know, I like these circuits, these steep climbs, and, you know, it beats being in the Spanish heat for 21 days.
Do you like circuit racing? I mean, do you think there should be more World Tour races on a circuit format?
I don't know if I should say more. You know, there's a lot of races that exist in a perfect way anyway, you know. Liège-Bastogne-Liège shouldn't become a circuit. It already is a big one. You know, it's a fun way to race, and it's really cool because the crowd gets to see you here 16 times before you even cross the finish line. So it's a good way to market cycling, but it's not always possible. And to talk about having circuits in a tour, that all of a sudden becomes impossible because, you know, if someone gets dropped, they're getting caught, and then how do you manage time cut and other logistical issues? So circuit racing's awesome, but there can only be so many.
What's the main difference, would you say, between Quebec and Montreal as races?
These climbs, you can go full gas from the bottom to top every single time, but in Montreal, you have to actually pace yourself. You know, I think here is 3,000 meters climbing total, and there is 4,300. So that's as much as any of the epic days, you know, that decide GC to Grand Tour. But it just comes at you on a lap that you do 15 times with two climbs. So it's something that, you know, your battery just runs out slowly, and then all of a sudden you just don't have legs.
So with Simon Gerrans at the start of the Quebec Grand Prix, Simon, how does it feel to be back here? I mean, you're the record, you know, winner here and winner of two of the two Grand Prix the same year. What's the feeling being back here in Canada?
It's always a good feeling to come back here to Canada and Quebec City, especially. I think the whole race enjoys coming here. It's a great trip over from Europe. Fantastic race, great crowd. So, yeah, it's a good trip.
We hear that's it. These races could be among your very, very last races of your career. It must be especially emotional, I suppose.
Yeah, they're amongst my last races. Sort of the season's kind of winding down a little bit now, but I still have a little bit of racing in October, so I have to keep riding for a bit longer yet.
Do you have already an idea of what's next, or is it too early to talk about it?
Yeah, no, after this, I have a quick trip back to Australia, then back to Europe again before heading off to the Japan Cup in October. So like I said, still a bit of racing left to go this year.
What would you say the 2014 successes you had here, how do they rate in your career, would you think?
Yeah, they're right up there with some of my best wins and my proudest moments in cycling. Like I said, it's a great trip. Everyone enjoys coming out here, so I'm really happy to have won here during my career.
Another rider I've been talking to, and this is recorded after the race, so in a way I know what the outcome of the race will be. Well, it confirms a trend I set in on the Tour de France to interview the day's winner before the start. I mean, it's sheer luck, let's be clear about it. And I talked to Michael Matthews, who finally wins in Quebec, about his season so far, why it's been so bad, and what his prospects for the end of the season are. Well, first of all, he'll explain that he had a problem with his saddle. He was actually not well positioned. He was a little bit too high, 8 millimeters, and apparently it affected his riding throughout the season. And that's the first thing he's going to answer about. And then, of course, we have a reaction to his non-qualification for the Worlds. Here is Michael Matthews. How did it affect you, Michael, that little difference in the seat height? I mean, it affected the legs, it affected what?
I think it affected everything. You could see from the way I was racing, I wasn't able to do anything. And then you could see straight away in Bing Bang and Plouay, as soon as I had the right seat height, I could race aggressively again like I should be. So, yeah, unfortunately it's like this, and I have to accept it and move on, I guess.
You've always been, you know, a major factor in the end of the season, especially with the Worlds coming. This year, the Worlds are a little bit different in Innsbruck. They're supposed to be for climbers. So how do you tackle the end of the season this year?
Yeah, well, I had really high hopes to go to the World Championships this year. Richie Porte is really one of my best friends, so I really wanted to go there and support him, but unfortunately Cycling Australia didn't think I could do a good job for the team and decided not to take me. So yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed, obviously. You really want to go to a world championship to help your help one of your really good friends out to win that gold medal and help Australia. And I think I would have been really good at that. But that was really my motivation for this end of the season, was to be good at the world championships. And I was training a lot with Richie Port before Bing Bang Tour. And I know what sort of form he's in. So, yeah, then I got the phone call just before Bing Bang that I wasn't riding. So, yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed, but at the same time, you never know. Something can happen to the guys that are in the team already, and maybe I can still get a spot. So that's been my motivation still to keep pushing and try and keep good results coming and see what happens.
The fact that you're not picked for the World Championships probably affects the way you're cycling these races.
Yeah, I think I would have to probably be... a little bit better climber if I was really targeting the World Championships to help Richie. But now that it's not on the cards anymore, I can focus on a little bit more punchy stuff, shorter climbs and having more power.
So winning here, I mean, you've been close many times, knowing that you know you don't have to hold anything. I'm not saying you have ever held anything, but that's probably, I mean, there's maybe even more of a chance this time.
Yeah, I know the question you're trying to ask. No, but yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, for me coming here this year, it's a little bit less stressful, I guess, especially after not doing the Tour de France. So normally you do the Tour de France, and then these races towards the end of the year, you don't need to train so much. You sort of, you've got your form. But coming here now, I've had to train a lot with not doing the Tour de France. So yeah, it's a different preparation. I'm just going to go into the race a lot more relaxed and with a clean head and not put so much pressure on myself to really win the race. I'm obviously going for it 100%, but yeah, I'll try and play some games and see what I can do, have fun, and I think that's when I race the best.
Now a quick summary of what the Quebec Grand Prix was about. As I said already, as we all know, if you're listening to that, you're cycling fans and you know that Michael Matthews won in Quebec City. Just quickly to sum up the racing in Canada, very often, and it was a case again in Quebec City, you have an early break, most of the time involving lots of Canadians and members of the Canadian team who try, you know, to show themselves at the highest level, and they usually lead for like 11 or 12 laps, collect KOM points, and, you know, and try to hold the peloton at bay as much as they can. Usually the peloton, you know, brings them back and runs them down in the last couple of laps. Then you've got several attempts. It was a case again this time with people like Jakob Fuglsang or trying their luck. And in the end, well, it was a case in both races this time. You have teammates trying to make sure the bunch stays as grouped as possible for their leaders to battle it out in the last stretch. That was the case here. The main part, the most important part in the race, well, the final climb, obviously, and the final stretch that goes from the Chateau Frontenac, where the riders are staying, which means that from time to time they go back to their rooms before the race is even finished. And then the final stretch goes up towards Grande Allée, which is kind of the Champs-Élysées or the Mall of Quebec City, and that's a long uphill sprint. And well, this time obviously it was won by Michael Matthews ahead of Greg Van Avermaet, who had to settle for second for the third year in succession, and Jasper Stuyven, who probably started his sprint a little bit too early, had to settle for another podium place. Stuyven, very gifted young rider, is still looking for his major breakthrough, but we're sure it'll happen sometime. I'm with Serge Arsenault, the founder and president of the Grand Prix Cycliste du Québec and Grand Prix Cycliste de Montréal. I mean, you personally, Serge, you always showed great respect for cyclists and for the sport of cycling. How did it start? I mean, you're Canadian, you should be into ice hockey, maybe Formula One a little bit, but how come cycling came into your life?
It was 1979. The mayor of Montreal, after the 76 Olympic, Summer Olympics in Montreal, said, "Serge, we should have something international so that it will be a kind of a downfall of the Olympics. And at that time, I chose the marathon. And after that, my father-in-law was kind of a rider in cycling, and he was always telling me, "Serge, you just pick up, the wrong sport. You should switch to cycling." And after that, 76, I covered the cycling as well. And in 88, I had a long conversation with Hein Verbruggen. He was starting the Coupe du Monde Perrier at that time. And his idea was, we have to get out of Europe and start to organize races on the other continent. Then I accept to organize these races. It was a tremendous success. And I felt in love with the sport, because we can make a parallel between the marathon and cycling. It is, at one point you will suffer. Then it's a love affair between the sport, the cycling, and myself. And again, I'm still, I feel like a kid. Cycling for me is a passion. Sometimes it's a costly mistress, but anyway, I enjoy it very much. And the cycling world give us back and everything, we give to them. We were dreaming of the best riders riders to the best races. And that's what we try to achieve. And we had to start, first of all, first consideration in organization was sport-wise first. Never take a decision that is not related to the sport. Don't fall in the trap of over-merchandising or whatever could happen, in business. Then, and I had Charlie Mottet, mm-hmm. A rider that I love very much in our team. And he is a little bit, the policeman of the Grand Prix. And he will make sure that everything is at, the right place for the right reason. Lots of soul. It's a brilliant mind. And he's the guardian, he's the guardian of what we are doing here, always with the same objective: organize the race for the riders, nothing else. And I believe that here in Quebec and Montreal, because of the physically the situation, everyone in the same hotel, riders, team, journalists, organizing people, it's great because everyone talk to each other, and we can have, with lots of pleasure, the friendly talk and serious talk sometimes, discussing about all these matters. And for example, yesterday, we know that every year we invite on the evening all the team director to be together, have a lunch, good glass of wine. And everyone leave at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we have solved, most of the problem of the world. But it's a small thing, but important, because right after that we feel that we're not opponent, enemy. We're not, one against the other.
When the Quebec City Grand Prix is finished, the riders are taken by bus to Montreal. It's a three-hour ride. Then they're accommodated in the very center of Montreal. It's not really an urban circuit. It's more around the park of Mont-Royal, and which was actually the race course for the 1976 Olympics, and was also the same course that was used for the Grand Prix des Amériques in the late 80s and beginning of the 90s. It's a very hilly circuit designed for climbers or sort of. Another little ascent was added this year to make it even trickier. But in the end, what did we have? Well, almost the same, riders we saw in Quebec City, with Michael Matthews, winning again ahead of Sonny Colbrelli, who was really, really, really set up and led out by his Baron Merida teammates, and looked like he was about to win it when Michael Matthews had the extra kick to go for victory. And I was in charge of the press conferences there, interviewing Michael Matthews about his success and about emulating Simon Gerrans by winning the two Canadian races. Here we are.
Yeah, I still can't really believe it myself, to be honest.
when I saw Simon Gerrans do this, I think it was in 2014, I was at the Volta, and it was something special for Cycling Australia to see an Aussie do both these races in a row, and it's been a massive goal for me to also try and achieve that. Simon Gerrans' career, he's had so many amazing results, and he's someone I've really looked up to, and for him to be here in the race today and witness me also doing what he was able to do in 2014, I think it's also really special. I think he also said it was his last World Tour race today, so it's pretty sad that he won't be in the peloton next year, but I'm just super happy that he was here to see also another Aussie achieve what he was also able to do a few years ago.
So it's still Monday, a few hours before we head back to the airport to make it back to Paris with most of the peloton heading back to Europe for the end of the season. And here at Club Espresso Café, we met Hugo Hull, who's one of the Canadian riders in the World Tour. He rides for Team Astana. And so, it was a chance to ask him what it's like to be a Canadian in the pro peloton these days, if it's easy or difficult, and here is what Hugo had to say. How important for Canadian riders are these two races?
Of course it's important for us. It's a good chance to show ourselves in front of our public, in front of the fans, and they were there yesterday really cheering hard for me in the breakaway. It was a great feeling. I race in Europe all year long, and it's just nice to race in front of my home crew and have fun. We have some really nice organization with Grand Prix Cycliste. They put us on the map with Quebec Cycling, and it helped to promote the sport all around the province of Canada, so really nice to be part of it.
It's been nearly 10 years, the Grand Prix now. Do you think it actually created vocations and guys who really get into cycling because of the Grand Prix?
For sure. I think all the kids you see on the side of the road, it just gave inspiration and it show what is cycling is in Europe and the culture. I think it's really important to show what is it, and I hope it inspires people to move more and get to cycling. We see a nice movement in Quebec in general. A lot of people go on the bike, not especially for racing, but just to train and talk with people and do also business meeting on the bike, so it's nice to see that, and the sport to keep growing.
How difficult is it for a Canadian to become a pro rider? I know that usually you have to move to Europe, away from family and friends, and even if the ones who stay in Canada, it's not very easy to train in the winter. Is it a handicap to be a Canadian, to be a pro cyclist?
There's an handicap, but there's also advantage, I think, sometimes. When we are in Europe, we are really focused, but it's really hard to be away from family, especially the girlfriend. Have to be away like half of the year, so I cannot see her and the family also. I always say when cycling go well, everything is cool, but when you start to have a shit feeling on the bike and you crash and you're alone in your small apartment in Europe, and then you're like, why I do all this sacrifice? Did I really like biking? And then the day after, you keep going because it's a great passion.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thanks very much to RAFA for being headline sponsor of the Cycling Podcast. And don't forget that RAFA hosts regular rides every day of the week from more than 20 clubhouses around the world. Visit rafa.cc to find your local ride. Now, there has been much talk about the CPA, the Professional Cyclists Association, in the week or so since David Miller announced his intention to challenge Gianni Bugno for the presidency. The vote is in Innsbruck next week, but a lot of riders appear to be unhappy at the system of voting and the fact that the CPA seems to be dominated by three countries, France, Italy and Spain. Some high-profile riders, including Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome, have been very vocal on social media in complaining that unless they physically go to Innsbruck, which in their case they're not, they will not be able to vote. It's become a fraught issue and is seen by some as an old world versus new world battle, though the Dutch and Belgian federations have also been unhappy with the way the CPA is run. And the CPA has its own legitimate complaints, not least the difficulty it's had in collecting the money owed by some race organisers. Lionel spoke to Miller about the CPA and about his campaign to become president. We'll hear from him in a moment. Then we'll hear from Laura Mora, the CPA spokeswoman who works closely with the current president, Bugno, and responds to some of the claims and comments made by Miller.
Well, I put myself forward as a candidate for the presidency of the CPA, which is the Cycliste Professionnel Associé, the International Professional Cyclists Union. And that's something that's been probably a couple of years in the brewing and then went off the boil this past year. And then when I found out about 5 weeks ago that there would be an election at the World Championships, I suddenly thought, you know what? If I don't do it, nobody else is going to do it and nothing's going to change. So I got in touch with the committee and the president and the president's secretary and told them on the 20th of August that I would like to put my hat in the ring. One of the reasons that I'm doing this as well is that since the CPA was created in 1999, it's only ever been had a presidency that's been handed over internally, if you like. The first president was Francesco Moser, then it was Cedric Vasseur, and since then it's been Jenny Bugno. And so there's never been an adversary candidate, which obviously when you don't have that, there's no debate. And there's actually never been any voting, really, because the committee of directors, which is made up of member nations, of which there are six, vote on behalf of the riders they represent. And that then gets a little bit complicated in the sense that there are six nations currently, because this year Belgium and the Netherlands pulled out of the CPA because of they didn't agree on certain things. And so each one of those member nations, those delegates, if you like, they then, I'd imagine, but I'm discovering they don't poll their riders. They make a decision themselves. They might ask a few influencers. So that means that there's six nations, France, Italy, Spain, USA, Switzerland and Portugal. And France have the most votes, and their president and their committee director, well, the committee representative, is Pascal Chanteur, and he carries 131 votes. Now, these votes are made up of each nation's world tour and pro-continental professional cyclists. And obviously the older nations like France, Italy and Spain have the most. As I said, France, 131. I still haven't got exact numbers from Italy, although they've been asking. 115 is what I got from the UCI, but that goes up or down 5 or 10. Spain, 90. USA, well, it's actually not USA, it's North America, the ANAPRC. They have 65 riders. Switzerland have 15. Portugal have 15. Again, taking into account that plus or minus of 5 to 10. And so that means that a total, the six members on the committee carry 431 votes, which is nearly 50% of the entire peloton of World Tour and professional cyclists. Those six members will make their vote on the 27th of September in Innsbruck at the World Championships at a committee meeting on the Thursday. And individual riders who are not represented by their nations or a member on that committee can vote, but they have to go to the assembly meeting in Innsbruck. Now, if we take into account there's around 200 riders in the World Championships, take away about 50 of those who are represented by members on the committee, that leaves approximately 150 riders who can vote, who will be in Innsbruck already, which means that essentially France, one person on the committee could beat all those riders if they chose, if we're looking at a sort of majority. So yeah, so it's a little bit of a weird system, and I think now the riders are now learning that it's perhaps not a very representative and democratic system. And I think that's, at the moment, that's the biggest push that I'm trying to educate people on, that that's something that needs to change. Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome don't have a vote because they won't be at the World Championships. to give a very sort of big example, if you like. And so, yeah, so if you like, the professional cyclists, they felt disenfranchised for quite a long time by the CPA because it's been working. It does some good work. Don't get me wrong. They've created a joint agreement between AGCIP, which is the Professional Teams Association, which puts into contract certain rights for professional cyclists, like minimum salary. Other things they could do more, and that needs to be something that's renegotiated in the next year. They've also, with the extreme weather protocol, that was actually something that I was the CPA representative that negotiated that with the UCI and the race organisers and the teams. They've got the Solidarity Fund, which is a fund of money that is part of how the CPA is funded, because the CPA is funded by taking a percentage, 2% off the total prize fund of the professional cyclists, and then that's what funds plus 100,000 euros approximately from the UCI annually. And then riders can then, when they stop racing, depending on the amount of years they've raced, they accrue a certain amount of points, which then gives them a payout when they retire. Now the maximum is 12,500 euros if you've done, I think that equates to about 10 years, and that's about where it ends, really. And unfortunately, because of the very fact that the riders feel disenfranchised and have never voted and weren't even aware of this vote and wouldn't have been if I hadn't put my name forward, it means that they're not really invested in it, and they're a bit disillusioned and they're not committed to it. And that's something that we need to change. So there's a total prize account, well, amounts that world tour and professional cyclists make, and the UCI obviously are aware of all that, and that's quantified. And up to now, that went through a company in the Netherlands mostly. Now that's been changed, it's going to another company. But out of all the total of that prize money, a percentage is retained and paid into a bank account in Switzerland, and that is then the CPA's money. For like, now a certain amount of that is for operations, a smaller percentage, and the rest is then accrued on behalf of this Solidarity Fund, it's called. Now it's a total of 2% that's taken off all those, that prize money, and the numbers are a bit sketchy, and this is something that I would like to change as well, because there hasn't been total transparency on the accounting. It needs to be independently audited. We need to know what's going on, because there is rumours that this fund is on the brink of insolvency, which is not good to hear. I'm not even sure if the CPA reports how it's spending the 100,000 euros it receives from the UCI each year. I'm pretty sure the riders have never received clear accounting of how the money is spent, either on operations or with the Solidarity Fund. So these are things that need to be clarified as soon as possible. At the moment, I can't see how I can win this election, because I think Jenny Bugno has already secured the Italian vote. So that's what, 115 riders already to his name. I believe France are committed as well, so that's 131. So we're talking 246 riders already, which means it's effectively impossible for me to win. But hopefully what this will do is wake up the peloton as a whole, and the media, and the CPA internally, that it's dysfunctional currently, and that the future of the CPA can't be it's remaining in this status quo, because the status quo is not good enough. We're a very strange sport in the sense it's quite disparate, in the sense that the riders are scattered everywhere, the contracts are short term, the teams are volatile at the best of times. And so the one consistency is the duration of the professional cyclist career. We're looking at probably a decent career is between 6 to 12 years. And that often involves going to different teams. Now, so that means the one consistency is the peloton. They're there. And I do believe, and I do stand by this, that the peloton can be the most influential and powerful voice in cycling. Because if we unify the peloton, then that will be the only entity in cycling that is unified. Race organisers are not unified. We have RCS, Flanders Classics, ASO, the list goes on. ASO is obviously towers above them all. That's not to say that they own the sport. The federations, national federations, again, are scattered, have different operation methods. The UCI is distant, and to be honest with you, shouldn't really be involved in the professional side of the sport. Television rights, scattered all over the place, and there's no sign on the horizon of that changing. So that means that there's one body within professional cycling that can be unified and can transcend all those different bodies, if you like, and that's the peloton. And I do believe if the peloton unifies and becomes strong, we can be at that table, we can help unify the other bodies that tend to be in these scattergun wars, and we tend to be the collateral damage. When I say we, I mean them. I'm no longer a we in the peloton, but I feel like I am, hence why I'm doing this. And I do think that the peloton can perhaps be a grounding force in the whole of professional cycling. Because let's face it, things are getting better, but they should be getting a lot better. And it's just not happening quick enough. At the moment, it's the CPA that represents the riders, and yet the riders barely know the CPA exists. The amount of riders I've spoken to, and especially young riders, who have no idea what Jenny Bunyo even looks like. In most of the CPA correspondence, it's never Jenny Bunyo's voice. It's always the President's Secretary, Laura Mora, or another CPA member who feels like talking up. The fundamental problem we have is that these decisions are made, and they're not the peloton's decisions. They're the CPA committee decisions, and they are not representing the peloton as a whole, the majority. And that is fundamentally wrong, and is not how a union should work. And this is the number one issue we have. The CPA has to represent the entire professional peloton, not six people's choice. There's women's CPA as well. There are two women's unions at the moment because they splintered. And in an ideal world, we bring them back together. There's no point in having resources split. We need to make sure the women's sport is unified as well. And I think they've paid a price for all this internal, if you like, battling. And to be fair, they've actually had the kind of foresight to splinter off and start their own union. And so, but the problem is that's now a conflict. There are two unions representing women's professional cycling. We need to try and bring them all back together, I think. And regards the World Tour professional and Pro Continental Tour, yes, at the moment that's all it is. And I think that's a big enough battle. We need to get that working first before we look further. Because that's already, as we can see, that's proving to be an incredibly difficult challenge. And I don't know, it's becoming quite daunting how difficult it is to change this, to not only rock the boat, but change its direction. It's Alessandra Cappelletto, who's the Italian, who is the president of the women's CPA equivalent. And so that's, you effectively have those two groups. And the Cycling Alliance, it makes sense, and it's been spoken of with the men as well. But for us, I don't see it as being a realistic option. We need to fix the CPA, because the CPA has the joint agreement with the AGCIP. It has the affiliation and the recognition of the UCI. And those are two huge things. And those are not the sort of thing you want to just ignore and step away from. And it would take many years to renegotiate those. And so I think the realistic, the pragmatic, and to be honest with you, the best option is to get the CPA working properly. There are, it's 900, I think just under 1,000 total riders. If we unify the World Tour and Pro Continental numbers, that's 1,000 riders. And at the moment, well, over 500 of those don't get a vote. Well, they do get a vote, but they'd have to turn up to the Worlds. And that's simply not going to happen. So I think my biggest, in these first weeks, if you like, of this kind of campaign, is to educate people, is to educate the peloton, because the peloton weren't even aware of this system. And it's taken weeks for me to extract it from the CPA, what the voting system is, because they've never had to apply it. It's just been internal discussions and agreements between the presidents of the affiliated nations, and they come to the deal. And I don't even think they do a proper vote to their riders they represent. They might speak to a few of them, and that's it. So that's not democratic, and that has to change. And yeah, it simply has to change. I've had quite a lot of good conversations. I did this, and after I informed Lauro Mora and Gianni Bugna, who then waited over 2 weeks to, or more actually, because Gianni, when I spoke to him, wasn't sure actually whether he would run when he learned of my candidacy, and then took him 2 weeks to decide, and then they informed the committee without informing me first. So already that was a bit of a grey area how that was all handled. But in that time, in those 2 weeks, I did reach out to a lot of riders, and the response has been overwhelmingly positive. So that's been reassuring, and obviously if it hadn't been overwhelmingly positive, I'd have had to rethink my candidacy. And you know what, I think as much of that support comes from the fact I represent change and willing to put my neck on the line to educate the peloton and the media of what's going on and to try and force change. So I think you know, that I represent as much that as anything else. So the first one is treating the riders as true members of their union, and that is the one rider, one vote, and then creating within that official roles in the peloton, a riders' congress of sorts, where you'd have a rider within each team who represents their voice to the CPA, and also creating, I think, we'd also, going back to actually the fundamentals beyond that sort of longer term, it is creating this total transparency into the bank accounts, this independent audit, this reset of everything that's happened to date. Then a renegotiation, once we've done that and hopefully won over the riders to a certain degree by creating this one rider, one vote, is then be able to discuss with them the option of either being able to raise the contribution prize money, to raise the funding that the CPA receives in order to recruit more professional staff, to increase its capabilities, but then also to increase the solidarity fund and the payout. It would also be to talk with corporate sponsorship, to look at trying to get insurance policies that cover the whole peloton, to look at getting support for riders not only during their career but in the transition after their career to let's call it the real world, because at the moment we have nothing in place to help riders when they finish bike racing. Should we be looking at creating educational programs, even looking into mental health issues? Because I think that's something we see over and over again, professional cyclists when they finish their career, the cord is cut, no one really sort of helps them in that transition. Being able to find a way of help riders that are injured or who lose their career. Again, that's something that CPA should carry a certain responsibility towards. Bring actual current riders to the negotiation subcommittee, if you like, that we create when we're doing the joint agreement with professional cycling teams, because that's something that at the moment, as we just discussed before, the riders don't actually have a current voice to help them and to share the message of what's going on when we're talking to teams. And then I think also there's something with 2018, creating a peloton-wide group messaging platform, this sort of thing where we can create this online presence where it is something that is live and up to date and also interactive. That's something we don't have. Increase the communication. The communication currently isn't up to 2018 standards, and that goes across all medium, be it the website, be it social media channels, be it press releases, be it relationships with the media. And to be honest, the list goes on, because there's so much that needs to be done that hasn't been done. It's not as if we're having to kind of rip everything up and start again. We've just got to start. These things haven't been done. You want to be able to get to a point where the riders respect the effort that race organisers, that TV companies are putting into the sport, because they've been at the table and they've shared the discussions, and there's a rational plan in place, even if it's not possible to do immediately, which it's professional cycling can be very difficult to do anything immediately, but there's a shared belief that things are changing, that there's a common future goal. And at the moment we don't have that. And I think, as you're saying, at La Vuelta and in many of the races we see these incidents happen, and yes, we've spoken about, and one of the things the CPA will say, they've helped with security. Yes, we've got the 3 kilometre rule put in place, and I think that was mainly the ANAPRC, the North American Union, that kind of pushed that through and created the document on it. but it's not been enforced. And although the UCI have technical advisors are now out on the road to verify situations, again, it's not being transmitted well enough what's going on. I mean, I think every pro cyclist will empathize with a race organizer. You can't have a race that's 3 weeks long, 200 kilometers every day, and 100% safe. There are always going to be incidents that are outside the organizer's control. So what we've got to try and do is limit what is possible. That 3 kilometer one seems a perfectly sane thing and controllable. Rather than ask for 200 kilometers, you ask for 3Ks. The 3Ks where it's the most critical points in the race, the final 3Ks, can we have that guarantee that it's always the same? Always the same, every single race that a peloton does. So there's a standard. Now, again, everybody understands that road dimensions are different, certain things, but there has to be a basic outline that is stuck to. And I think it's things like that. And I think at the moment we get the peloton joined together, unified, rather than use the word union, but joined in unity, then there's the potential to have really rational, intelligent and productive conversations between the different stakeholders. At the moment, there are no conversations between the stakeholders. It's simply reactionary. It's social media, individual reactionary. And the reason the riders go on social media to react is because that's the only voice they have. Who else are they going to speak to? And that's the point, and that's what we've got to change. I think the CPA has to be strong enough to be able to help riders if they get into this situation where a contract from a team is terminated. And perhaps that's something that is cemented, that is made stronger within the joint agreement between the teams. But again, these are things that seem like fundamentals, but it's never been done in the sport. The sport is so, I often think it's a global sport, but operates like a cottage industry. And the fact that in a sport this big, on the global side, if you like, and the audience, has these situations arise regularly, it's not really good enough. And I don't think the UCI and the ASO's vision of just reducing teams and numbers, well, that's not going to solve anything. That's just a short-term solution to a long-term problem. And so I think we've really got to think, bring new people into the sport, bring new minds, bring a bigger unity. And we're all in the same boat. Let's get it working properly. And rather than jumping off on lifeboats or just running around plugging holes and bilge pumping, because that's what it feels like at the moment.
I mean, first of all, I mean, does the CPA feel that the current voting system is fair?
No, actually, I mean, I don't know how to answer. I mean, we don't feel that it's fair in the sense that it doesn't effectively allow many riders to express their vote. But at the same time, we must respect the statutes, and at this point, we can't change everything. We can't change the things. We never had this issue brought to our attention before, neither from David or other members that were sitting at our table. And we didn't think about this because it never happened then that the electronic vote was used in other situations, like, for example, the Athletes Commission or UCI Commission. I mean, every time we have to take part to the UCI commissions, we always have to be present there. And the UCI itself never used these voting methods before. We didn't think about this, but now that every rider asks for this kind of voting methods, we will definitely consider it in the future. I mean, both presidents, no matter who will be, I think will change the status and make sure that all the riders will have this right. I mean, but it wasn't our intention to avoid this electronic vote. It was just not possible to put it in place at the last time with such a short delay of time.
There's obviously been quite a lot of riders have been quite vocal on social media and so on, complaining about not having the opportunity to vote. Does that concern the CPA that, you know, the people that you represent, a lot of them do seem to be unhappy?
Are the majority of the riders complaining about not being represented or not having the CPA to do well his job for them? because maybe these riders, these few riders, and only riders coming from some particular countries complain, but there are many more that don't. So you should be fair and consider the entirety of the peloton. I mean, we have tried to respect the rules. We opened our door and we let people come into our meetings, and we founded new association and we pushed new members to create new national associations. Why all these people, starting from England, never took action? Why there is no English National Association? In this way, this association with one person, the president of the National Association, would have been able, for example, to vote for all their riders. But, I mean, these people knew the rules. These people knew the statutes. Why they didn't do anything in order to represent their riders? And they didn't even ask for an electronic vote, even David Miller. I mean, it's not fair now, 3 weeks before the election, to erase the riders against our voting methods. I mean, he should have come earlier and asked for this and discussed this at our tables. And if we would have time, we would have do everything possible in order to make it real. I mean,
I
mean, everybody now is talking about the CPA as not being a democracy, trying to hide things, not to allow riders to vote. But this is not true. We are actually surprised because these people who's asking for these new voting methods didn't ask for this change before. They were at our tables. They never did. We met David Miller in January 2017. We proposed to become vice president of the CPA, and we wanted him to come to our working sessions. He never did. He came 3 weeks before the election, and saying everywhere on the media, social media, that the CPA is not democratic because we don't allow an electronic vote. He should have come earlier, I think. And I'm not talking in favor of Bunge, I'm talking in favor of CPA and the work I do for the CPA. It's very sad to see what we read on the social media. It's not fair.
As well as the obvious English-speaking writers who we've heard a lot from on social media, some of the traditional cycling countries like Belgium and Holland have obviously withdrawn from CPN. It does look from the outside as if a lot of power is in the hands of, well, three countries in particular, France, Italy and Spain.
Yes, you're right. I mean, Belgium and Holland were historically the founder of the CPA. We were together until a certain point, and I tell you when the UCI decided for a new plan for the prize money management. So we must say why this association decided to get out from the CPA. It's not because the CPA is a not democratic association, but because there were different interests behind their going out. They decided to go out. They didn't want to stay after this decision on the prize money management was made. And the truth is that the founder of the Dutch Association is also an entrepreneur into the business of the prize money management. He didn't agree about our decision, our plan, and he decided to get out, and he started his personal fight against the CPA. And this is not fair. I mean, we thought that the good of the riders come before the personal interest of someone. And the Belgian riders followed 2 months later. And this because the Dutch decision and this particular person influenced the Belgian Riders Association. We asked the Belgian Association to give us the minutes of the assembly where the riders decided to getting out from the CPA, and we never received the minutes of that assembly. We also have many Belgian riders, even leaders, very important leaders, supporting us. And when they have problems of any case, safety, prizes of any kind, they contact us. And they contacted us even before, when they had a Belgian association. So maybe before we say that the Dutch and the Belgian associations decided to leave the CPA, we should know a little bit more what's behind their decision.
I mean, finally, Laura, the other thing that David Miller says, and I don't know if this is true or not, but he says that he thinks the CPA Riders Fund is not in good health. I mean, is that true, that the rumor that, you know, that the funds are not in great health, or is that incorrect?
Okay, so this is another thing that first of all, I wonder how David can know this kind of thing, since he never came to our meetings. He never participated, as I said. The last time we saw him was in January 2017. And once again, before that date, was in April 2015. So we only saw David twice. He was too busy with his personal business and never had the time to come. But besides that, the fund has a problem, yes, that the 5% that the organizer should pay from the prize money to fund this rider fund hasn't been enough to pay all the requests from the riders when they finish their careers. There have been more riders in the last years asking for this fund, and the way the fund was put in place at the origins doesn't allow at this moment to pay effectively all the riders. There are 60, 70 riders in the last years asking for the fund, and the 5% that the fund can count on would not be enough to pay all the requests. But first of all, this was something that came out only in the last years, because at the beginning it wasn't like that. There were many riders asking for the fund. Second, we have always paid all the riders. No riders have ever complained because he didn't receive the money. And we used for this point the money of the CPA. So basically, we always made sure that the riders had what they asked, even if the fund didn't have enough money to support all the requests. One of the reasons why also the CPA had to borrow some money to the fund is because many organizers during the last year didn't pay in time this 5% to the fund. We tried in many ways to make these organizers pay. Some of them are China, Turkey, countries that don't respond, that don't take action when you ask them to do so. We asked many times to the UCI to help us in collecting all the credits of the fund towards these organizers, and the work is still on place, but the UCI itself wasn't able to obtain what we wanted from the organizers. So all this story that the fund is managed in a not transparent way, or that the fund, we are doing strange things with the money of the fund, is a bullshit. And there is another point. We have worked very hard on a new prize money management system. The prize money management system that will take place since 2019 is an important project, not only for the prize money itself, but also for the payment of the fund. Finally, with this digital platform and with this system, all the organizer will pay also the 5% to the transition fund automatically, without delay, and in a transparent way.
Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Usually at this point we give out the 25% discount code, but for the rest of this month they're offering an even bigger discount to celebrate the various successes of Science and Sport athletes, from Geraint Thomas at the Tour de France to Adam Peaty's world record. So for the rest of the month you can get up to 50% off lots of Science and Sport products, and also get an extra £5 off with the code CHAMPIONS. That's at the website scienceandsport.com. Now, during the Vuelta, we ran a competition to win some Rafa and Science and Sport swag, and we have our winners. The winner of the Rafa goodies is Jacqueline Young, and Nicholas Vincent is our Science and Sport winner. Please email contact@thecyclingpodcast.com if you are Jacqueline Young or Nicholas Vincent, and we can arrange to send you your prizes.
Hello, and welcome to the Tour of Britain Diary. That's me, Conor Dunn. Gonna be talking a bit over the next month about firstly my preparations to Tour Britain, and then discussing everything that happens during the race. Trying to keep a bit of a diary of what goes on, the ups, the downs, everything else in between. All the porridge I'll be eating, which is quite a lot. Getting ready for what's probably gonna be my last target of the year. So here we are, 1 week out from the start Tour of Britain. 7 days to go till the start in Cardiff. Been a bit of a mental morning, to be honest. Woke up to the news that the team was folding, and the team's not continuing, so I've got no job after Tour of Britain. Well, after this year finishes. Everything's a bit up in the air, I guess, now. Gone from looking to show myself off on Tour of Britain as kind of a nice way to show off the Irish National Champs jersey with no pressure and a contract already signed, to back to the drawing board, really, back to nothing on the table. So race has completely different meaning for me. Now it's last chance saloon, to be honest. Now I've got to race it as if it's my last race and my last shop window to keep myself in this sport. So a bit of a mad thing to get my head around this morning.
So Gabs, just finished drop of coffee there, talking about this week. What are you looking forward to most about this week, and how do you think it's going to pan out?
I think mainly just be a really good week with the boys. It's pretty unexpected coming into this week, because we thought the season would be done last week, but it's nice to finish at such a big stage with everyone. I've not really had a chance to look at all the stages yet. I'm just going to take it day by day because they all look pretty tough, so I think treat each day like a one-day race. That stage one looks good, nice little climb, 7k to go, I think. So yeah, I think the form's good, so I look forward to getting stuck into that one.
Nice one. A few jerseys to pick up also.
Yeah, and they're like college jerseys as well, aren't they? So yeah.
How to get the finger right.
Yeah.
So here we are, the day before mine and Larry's great adventure. Everything over the week's happened so quickly. It's kind of mad to be here. I've just been down to a generic sports centre and bought a load of bike packing bags, all whacked them on the bike. I have no idea what I'm doing. Literally bought a load of lights, just light myself up like a Christmas tree. Just being ingenious in where I place certain things. I think I'll be all right. Luckily my bike's massive, so fit a good bit on it. But I'm just so excited, to be honest. Never been this excited to ride my bike since I was about 6 years old.
So I'll ask the big man, Jimmy Fouché, the Flying Mullet. How are you doing, Jimmy? What's the crack?
Yeah, good, thanks. Just spent the last week and a bit in Belgium doing a few one-day races in a Kermis, which is good with the boys. And got a bit of speed in the legs, not knowing what was coming up this week.
Morale good? Morale good in the camp, Jimmy?
Yeah, definitely. It's always good.
Yeah. Will we expect to see you someday up the road this week?
That's the plan.
That's the plan. Of course we will.
Try find it.
And get round.
Yeah, get round as usual.
I had to apologise to Connor about 5 minutes ago because I realised I was getting a bit grumpy. I guess part of this whole journey is to sort of realise you don't need to be so serious all the time, because every time he pulls out his phone or stops for a photo, I'm kind of like, let's crack on. I actually haven't told Connor this yet, so you guys are the first to hear, but I'm learning,
basically
I'm improving, and I'm sorry.
It's okay, Larry.
After everything being so negative the last, well, it was a hard, tough week before we left, and then we were saying, like, the other day on our ride, we feel like fresher than we did when we left. It's mad, just because of how much fun we had, really, and how happy we were. So
it's amazing how hard you can train when you're having fun.
Yeah, like today I just decided to empty myself on the way home.
Connor's emptied himself literally every day.
But it's just because we're having fun and enjoying it. So
yeah, it's been an awesome time. And we're both so lean now, it's awesome.
I guess, like, it's kind of sad we don't really want it to end.
But, I know.
That's it, really. Got to enjoy our ice creams and get on with our lives.
Problem is, I'm almost done with my ice cream, so
try and find a job.
No-go tour done, ice cream done. What the hell do I do now?
Maybe we can be gelatoists.
A sample there from the two special episodes we're releasing this week for Friends of the Cycling Podcast. Sign up as a friend at thecyclingpodcast.com. Mark Downey's Tour of Britain diary came out earlier this week, and Connor and Larry's no-go tour diary is imminent. As I said earlier, it's a bumper episode full of humour and quite poignant in places as well, and also an epic at about an hour and 45 minutes. But then it was an epic ride. And speaking of epic rides, a couple of months ago, Lionel did a long bike ride, a longish bike ride with Ned Bolting. That's for something that's coming up on the Cycling Podcast in the autumn/winter. But while they were riding their bikes, Lionel asked Ned about his one-man show, Tour de Ned, which is about to start. It kicks off on September the 28th in Southampton and includes 22 nights all around the country, including, I was surprised to see, Arbroath.
So here we are on the Cambridge Southwold Cambridge Classic, but you're deep in preparation for the Tour de Ned.
I should be. Shouldn't be out riding this, really. I should be slaving over, you know, my desk trying to invent gags. I've written a bit. So the third year of my one-man comedy theatrical extravaganza national tour thing, I thought I'd better write some totally new material and strip it down to what people really care about, which I think is the Tour de France. So I'm waiting to see whatever happens on this year's Tour de France, because something's going to happen, isn't it? A bus is going to crash into something, you know, an inflatable arch will collapse on something, and, you know, something daft will happen almost every day. Because that's the fascination of the race. And then I'm going to kind of try and recreate it on stage. So, and with, you know, digressions and diversions and little dips into history and a lot of fun. There's a gate just closing in the background. A lot of fun. And the idea is to have a right old laugh, but also relive the action in July in a kind of daft theatrical style. But that's it, yeah.
When's the tour start, and will you be riding between any of the venues?
Yes, some of them are close enough, some of them aren't. The tour gets underway probably while you're listening to this podcast, so late September gets underway, and then all of October and November I'm on the road. Conveniently, 21 venues, so it's the 21 stages of the Tour de Ned.
And how many rest days?
Enough, just about. But oh, Lionel, it's such a wonderful, nerve-wracking, weird life doing that. But yeah.
Well, we did something similar, but on a much smaller scale with the cycling podcast. Yeah. And I remember talking to you around the time that we were doing that tour. I had this vision that because the events are in the evening and all we had to do was sort of travel, oh, there'll be so much time. I'm going to be inventing time to do other things. But you just can't, because everything is fixated on that evening's event and what you're going to say and the kind of the nerves of appearing in front of a crowd. You must still, yeah, even though you've done a couple of years of these, you must still get those nerves.
I get extremely nervous every time. I'm locked on. It's a one-man show, so I've only got me, really, and my wonderful stage manager on whom I rely. But he's busy doing stuff up on the stage, talking to the theatre technicians. And once they open the house, so I'm getting all the lingo, you see, now, you know. Once the house is open, I'm locked into my changing room, my green room, and I can't come out, really. So I'm just on my own. Obviously with my extravagant rider, you know, which features all sorts of, you know, wild...
What's in your rider?
Bananas and water. And I'm just listening to... They all have these little funny little tannoy speakers in green rooms through which they can make announcements to you. But basically you hear the ambient noise of the theatre filling up. So you kind of get this hubbub of anticipation, and it's all... You've got to go out and do it. And until you kind of, you know, you've done the first gag and people like it and they kind of, you can't really relax. And then it's great. Then it's just a load of fun.
Oh, that hubbub, that's making the butterflies in my stomach, just the memory of it. Every night, never quite knowing whether it's going to be okay. And it's a bit like cycling in that sense. You have good days and bad days. Some days it just flows and other nights not so much.
Talking about butterflies in your stomach, you complaining a bit earlier you got a touch of the Tom Dumoulin's kicking off.
Mm.
How's it? How's
I think it might be the sausage and bacon bap. Sausage and bacon bap's revenge. Yeah, might need to go and do a Dumoulin.
Anyway, tickets.
Oh, yes.
www.nedbolting.com. There you go.
That's all for this week. A big thank you to Francois Thomaso for his report from Canada, and also to the three producers who've worked on this week's show, Adam Bowie, Will Jones and Tom Wally. Orla Shinawee and I are off to Innsbruck for the World Championships next week, and we will return with a regular-ish episode.